We suspect the news will slow down a little bit after today as we head into the Easter holiday weekend, but we have news to discuss today on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I am Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Layla Tassi, and Laura Johnston, and we got a good juicy one to start the podcast with. This seems counterintuitive because who would want more terms of Matt Huffman as Senate president? But many believe Ohio term limits have saddled us with a never-ending string of inexperienced legislators who become beholden to the much better informed lobbyists. Is momentum building for ending Ohio's legislative term limits? Lisa, what's the argument in favor?
Yeah, at least in some circles, they're talking about it. And I can't say I disagree with some of them. But term limits in Ohio for state lawmakers have been in place since 1992 when voters approved a constitutional amendment. And this limits House and Senate members to 8 consecutive years. Some leaders say that term limits, it's time for them to go. And House Speaker Jason Stevens is among them. He made some unsolicited comments in a December meeting with reporters. And he said a lot of people are thinking about an amendment to end legislative term limits. So that would be 2 4-year terms for senators and 4 2-year terms for the House. But as we know, when they run against term limits in one chamber, they move to the other. He says that too much turnover is resulting in inexperienced lawmakers tackling major policy issues. He says you've got $100 billion in budget proposals to figure out in 6 months, and you don't even know where the bathrooms are. And he also said that there would be no castle drama. And what he was saying, referring to there, is the fight with Senator Matt Huffman, who is term limited in the Senate, who has made no bones about his plan to move to the House and become Speaker. Former Representative Mike Curtin, a Democrat from Columbus, wrote a short history on term limits. He said Ohio had one of the most experienced legislatures before term limits and now has one of the among the most least experienced legislatures in history. Senate President Matt Huffman says he's aligned with Stevens on this. He says term limits takes power from lawmakers and gives it to a permanent bureaucracy in state government because they have more longevity and experience. He also says it's reduced the power of the people.
Think about that, though. Right now, there is nothing more powerful in Ohio than the legislature because of gerrymandering. That's a preposterous statement by Matt Huffman that the executive branch has all the power. That's simply not true. This is so conflicting because everything you just said about why they're bad is absolutely correct. These new legislators come in, they don't know beans, and the lobbyists who are getting paid big time by different interests that do not work in favor of basic Ohioans steer them all over the place because they're more expert, and that's a bad thing. But what Huffman and Stephen want, they want to be kings. They don't want anything to remove them from their positions of power. This is a legislature that worked really hard last year to neutralize the voters' ability to change the Constitution because they wanted all the power. What they're doing is the same thing. They're trying to create king for life kind of things. But this is a case where even if their motives are terrible because they're just power-hungry megalomaniacs, it's probably in the best interest of Ohioans to do it. I'm so conflicted on this one.
I am too, but I have never really been for term limits. And, you know, as an editorial board member, I can't tell you how many, and you know this, how many terribly inexperienced people who have never run for public office or like want to be Congress members or state lawmakers, you know. So I'm all for experience, but, you know, voters have to be engaged. They have to be informed, you know, to be able to deal with not having term limits.
Let's face it, the voters went with term limits out of frustration with their state government. So you can say it was a much more experienced state legislature, but voters were very unhappy with the state of Ohio and the decision making. That's why they did this. And I'm not sure they can get 50% of the voters to change it. They certainly couldn't get 60%, which is what they would have been required to do if they had been successful last year on issue one. The voters are frustrated. They want to throw the bums out. They, you know, the Republicans voted for outsider Bernie Moreno, not the insiders, Frank LaRose and Matt Dolan. So I'm not sure that the voters will buy that this is better to get entrenched lawmakers, because when they had it before, it didn't work. And then you look at people who've been around forever, like Bill Seitz, who still says HB6 was a good thing. Do you really want that? Do you want people like Bill Seitz to be there year after year after year working against the interest of Ohioans?
But can we point out that they are there year after year after year because they just switch chambers back and forth, so they've gotten around the term limits? And also, how hilarious it is that they say it's demeaning to the power of the people. They don't want the people to have any power. They just
right,
want to keep
which
it for
was
themselves.
What issue one was about last year, and that's what this is. Look, these guys, you can't trust their motives ever, but there is a very— Mike Curtin is right that there is something to be said for having expertise in the state house, because right now you have a bunch of neophytes, and we can see how easily this legislature is bought and paid for. So it's fascinating. If they put it on the ballot, it'll be a very interesting question on how the voters feel about it.
Yes, it will.
And
go ahead. No, I was just going to say, a Pew Research Center poll conducted recently says— I know how you feel about polls, but they say 87% of U.S. adults favor congressional term limits and only 12% are opposed.
Well, and that's different than a candidate horse race poll. There is some evidence that issue polling is actually pretty accurate. And that's the problem, is every time Ohioans have been asked about term limits, whether it's nationally or in the state level, they favor them. So it would take an education campaign. Of course, you know, we launched an education campaign last year about issue one to stop Matt Huffman and Frank LaRose and company from neutralizing our power as voters. If we believe in this, we could launch an editorial campaign to support it. But I'm not quite sure where our board would come down on it. This will be an interesting question. Great that they're talking about it. It's a serious issue that deserves examination, even if their motives are completely selfish. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Why is Sherrod Brown exercised about the size of portions in retail products these days? And how does he plan to regulate it? It must be an election year, Laura.
Yes, because you think this is— if we're going to talk retail prices at the grocery store, this is where people talk about economics, and this is where they see it every week. So yes, I do believe this is an issue most Americans would get on board with. It is shrinkflation, which honestly, I've never seen this word before. Obviously, it's made up between shrinking and inflation, but it's when corporations raise the consumer costs by reducing the size of their products without lowering prices. So you're buying that same package of Oreos that you thought you've always been buying, but there are fewer cookies in the box. And that's where Sherrod Brown gets upset. He's joining in with Cookie Monster, who has taken this to social media and saying this should not be allowed, that the practice is particularly common among household paper products, cleaning products, snacks, and candy. So he and some colleagues introduced a bill called the Shrinkflation Prevention Act that would order the FTC to establish shrinkflation as an unfair or deceptive practice, and then the FTC and state attorneys could go after offending corporations.
How does that work, though? I mean, when you buy a product, it lists what the ounces are on the product or the units in the product, then you see the price. And actually, in many stores— I don't know if it's the law or not in this state, it is in other states— there's unit pricing. You pay X per X.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you can regulate this. This seems like a ridiculous government overstep. We're consumers. When you go into the store, you can see what the price is for the product. What is the huge violation here? Yes, they're gouging us because they're making more money, but instead of raising the price, they're giving you less product. That's the choice. You can buy it or not.
Right. You don't have to buy double stuffed Oreos every week when you go to the grocery store, which apparently the pack used to be 1 pound, 4 ounces, now weighs in at 1 pound, 2.71 ounces. So this is not a huge jump. And there's a report federal government put out saying that this is a very, very small part of inflation, that the impact has been minimal. But I do think this plays to a base. The people who go to the grocery store— it's the same as, like, how many stories have we seen about egg prices being so high? And it's like, okay, egg prices are high, but eggs are really cheap to begin with. So how much is it really affecting your annual budget?
But what does he want the government to do? Does he want the government to regulate what the companies can put into their product? You can't sell a package of Oreos unless it has 30 Oreos in it. I mean, is that really the government's role to get in between the consumer and the supplier like that?
That's a good question.
I get it. Nobody likes paying more for less, but I mean, you don't have to. You don't have to pay more for less. If you think it's offensive, you can look elsewhere. I just don't get how the government should get involved in this. This is the opposite of what the government's supposed to be doing. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Forget for a moment, a Cuyahoga County judge thought it was a good idea to make the controversial labor leader Dave Wondolowski a grand jury foreman. Shame, shame, shame on Rick Bell. What were you thinking? What we need to talk about, though, is how Wondolowski could lead a grand jury investigating the corrupt HB6 in the State House when he was actively involved in getting that law passed. Layla, what gives here?
Yeah, first of all, yeah. Why is it that Dave Wondolowski seems to pop up everywhere? Here he is as the foreperson of the grand jury who indicted Larry Householder. And as Andrew Tobias pointed out in his story, Wondolowski lobbied publicly for HB6, which was supported by most elements of organized labor in the state. The Cleveland Building Trades and Construction Council gives to Republican and Democratic candidates around the state and gave at least $14,000 in campaign contributions to Householder when he was speaker. And in early 2022, Wondolowski also briefly served on the nominating council for the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, where he was appointed by Governor DeWine to help screen potential PUCO commissioners. The PUCO is part of a related case brought by AG Dave Yost's office in Summit County against Sam Randazzo, who served as the PUCO chairman from 2019 until 2020, and two former First Energy executives who are accused of bribing him. So Wondolowski's entanglements could really create some legal complications for the state. You know, one legal expert told Andrew that Householder's defense lawyers are likely to ask about Wondolowski's role in the grand jury to see whether he played a part in reviewing the case. Under state judicial rules, a jury foreperson's role includes, you know, swearing in witnesses, tabulating the vote from grand jurors about whether a case should advance, announcing the results, and signing the indictments. And the grand jury members themselves are randomly selected, but the foreperson is typically a community leader who's chosen for their ability to kind of keep the grand jury on task. So it's possible that Wondolowski did recuse himself from the grand jury discussions on this case and that his electronic signature was just kind of affixed to the indictment automatically. But we don't know because the grand jury process is so highly secretive.
Well, his signature on it taints the whole thing. They should dismiss this case and start over with a different grand jury because this will create problems. It is a clear conflict of interest. It's as clear as Pat DeWine's was in the gerrymandering case. So we know how that ended up. But it's just obscene that he did not recuse himself or they didn't take it to a different grand jury. We usually have multiple grand juries operating at any one time and they rotate the judge approvals. Rick Bell should never get a choice again because this is preposterous that you would put Wondolowski on this. Remember what he did in the mayor's race? The offensive things he said about Justin Bibb? Do we really want this guy leading a grand jury? But as soon as it's an HB6 investigation, what is everybody thinking? This is an automatic, hey, I can't touch this. I was heavily involved in that case, so I'll either recuse or take it to a different grand jury. But the fact we're sitting here now, I guarantee you Dave Yost was not aware of this because he would have seen this coming. He's smart. But the only path here, dismiss it right now before it goes a step further, waste any more money. Take all the evidence to a different grand jury, get a new indictment.
Yeah, it's almost certain to create problems. I mean, you know, Andrew reached out to Householder's defense lawyers and they clearly intimated, you know, oh yeah, we were pretty surprised to see Wondolowski's name on that indictment. So you're right, they should just start over before another penny is spent on this case.
It's the only path. Anything else is just wasting money, wasting time, because this case will ultimately get dismissed. What a ridiculous situation. And really, Rick Bell, you are out of your mind naming him to the grand jury. You're listening to Today in Ohio. How does the Cleveland Clinic, a nonprofit agency, get away year after year after year with failing to spend its billions of dollars and its fortune on helping the community? Isn't that what a nonprofit is supposed to do? Where does the clinic stand in the latest rankings of hospitals report on how they help their communities, especially compared to the very many tax breaks that we all grant them. Laura.
So this is the Loan Institute's list, and you're right. Every year, they're near or at the top of this list. It is not something they brag about in banners like the U.S. News and World Report rankings, but this is the worst in community spending in the nation, and they receive more tax breaks than they give back in the community, which is called a fair share deficit. And the Cleveland Clinics was $212 million last year, according to the Loan Institute. UH had a $61 million deficit that ranks second among the Ohio hospital. And so the Loan Institute has its own calculation for this. It's not based on anything that's in the federal guidelines for taxes or anything, but it's the financial assistance and community investment minus the tax exemption. And so that includes free or discounted care to eligible patients, community health improvement services, subsidized health services grants, community activities that address the drivers of health, like affordable housing. The clinic says this is not a fair metric, that they do a lot for the community that is not included in the Loan Institute results. They said, you know, all of the research we do is good for humanity. All of the training we do for medical students is a big deal. But and all the Medicaid we provide. But Loan says they don't include those because Medicaid is repaid even if it's not as much as it costs the hospitals, and that research and training are not the same thing as a community impact for the neighborhood around them. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the clinic and how it treats the neighborhood around it.
They've got billions of dollars that they're sitting on. If they just took $1 billion or half of that and invested it in improving community health, what kind of difference could it make? We've talked so often about the disparities in health outcomes, and year after year after year, they are ranked as one of the worst in the country for reinvesting. They're centered in neighborhoods that are in poverty and need the help. And yet they say, well, it's unfair. It's unfair. It's not unfair. You have billions and billions of dollars. You're not supposed to have profit. You're supposed to reinvest what you get into your purpose. And they're not doing it.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny because, you know, every so often we get the envelopes from the clinic foundation asking us to donate. And it's like, this is not where my donations are going to be going this year to the Cleveland Clinic. When you think about how expensive healthcare is and how many worthy causes there are in this world. And you're right. We talk all the time and we don't have answers about the disparity in health and why infant mortality is so high in Cleveland and why Black patients have such worse health outcomes. And the clinic could do something about them. And I applaud them for their research. That's great. I'm glad they train all of those medical students. But really, they are not paying taxes on any of their buildings. And just think about the clinic buildings, you know. I mean, this is all over the place. It's not just in the main campus, which is a monolith in of itself. They are tax exempt. They are a nonprofit. And they are not contributing.
And if they were for profit, the taxes would be huge. And that would be an investment back in the community. So, but they're nonprofit with the thought that they reinvest, and they clearly are not. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Lisa, you weren't here for a lot of years, but for decades, the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections provided precinct breakdowns on voting overnight on election days. Year after year, election after election, that data was available almost immediately. We'd get up the next morning, we could do instant analysis. The current management is taking over a week, blaming their software upgrade. They actually call it an upgrade. It's ridiculous. It took a week to get this stuff this time, but now that we have it, what did we learn about Cuyahoga County voting patterns in last week's Senate primary?
Well, as we know, in that Senate race, Bernie Moreno, the winner, took all 88 counties in Ohio. In Cuyahoga, though, he got 49% of the vote. He won 35 of the 59 cities within Cuyahoga County. Dolan got 40% of the Cuyahoga vote. He won 22 cities, including his Chagrin Falls hometown. And Secretary of State Frank LaRose got only 11% of the vote in Cuyahoga counties, and he didn't take any communities within Cuyahoga. Now, Dolan got the most support in the East Side Outer Ring suburbs and the Northwest Side. So Orange, Shaker Heights, Chagrin Falls, and Bentleyville. He got more than 60% of the vote there. Moreno was strongest in Woodmere, Newburgh Heights, Brook Park, Oakwood, and Brooklyn. But he lost his Westlake hometown to Dolan in a very narrow result there. Secretary Frank LaRose said that, he took East Cleveland with 35.9% of the vote. He also did well in Woodmere and Highland Hills. Now, if we look at the places where these podcasters live, Dolan did well in all of them. Bay Village, he took 51% of the vote to 41.5% for Moreno. Cleveland Heights, that was the biggest gap between Dolan and Moreno. Dolan taking 52% and Moreno taking 35.8%. And then in Rocky River, 48.3% voted for Dolan there. And in Lyndhurst, 45.1% voted for Dolan, 42% for Moreno. So actually Moreno did, yeah, he was still behind, yeah.
Interesting to look at it through that lens, Lisa. Good perspective. You're listening to Today in Ohio. And I should say, I wish Jane Platton would come back and run the elections office, because when she ran it, it was great. And she wouldn't tolerate a week-long delay in giving us those results. For people who don't live in Northeast Ohio but want to be here for the eclipse on April 8th, what are the chances of finding a hotel room at this point, Layla?
Well, Susan Glaser tells us that if travelers haven't already booked their travel plans and their hotel stays, they shouldn't expect any last-minute deals. And probably you're going to have a hard time finding a place to stay for under $1,000 anyway. Tourism companies that track travel demand are showing a surge in rates along the path of the eclipse. Hotels in our area are nearly sold out on Sunday, April 7th, the day before the eclipse. Cleveland tourism officials believe that as many as 200,000 visitors could travel here. And also, it's important to note that the eclipse is happening a day after the city plays host to the NCAA Women's College Basketball Championship game. So we'll already be saturated with tourists who are here for that. A recent study by Priceline found that the average price of a hotel room in Cleveland from April 6th to the 9th was $472. That's up 109% over the same period last year. And Cleveland area hotel searches are up more than 1,500% from the same time a year ago. Research from Amadeus Hospitality showed Cleveland area hotels were 74% booked for April stays back in late February. That's higher than other cities in the path of totality. So, Greater Cleveland, we're one of the most booked destinations for the eclipse, according to Airbnb. But there are still listings available, apparently. You can get a 4-bedroom house in Strongsville for $1,000 a night, or a 2-bedroom condo in downtown Cleveland for $893 for a one-night stay. But we were talking in the newsroom yesterday about what happens if it becomes obvious that we're going to have overcast for the eclipse. I mean, do people just cancel their plans, or are the hotel stays refundable? That's a lingering question.
I wonder how many people who were coming here for the Final Four, seeing that the eclipse was Monday, just got the extra night and figured may as well stay in Cleveland for that. And whatever happens with the weather, there'll be people here for the Final Four. And with Caitlin Clark coming, it's going to probably be the most watched women's Final Four ever if the team makes it to the Final Four.
You know, hearing those Airbnb rates reminds me of when we hosted the RNC in Cleveland. And right. Clevelanders rented out their homes at a premium and just kind of went on vacation for that week. So I don't really care that much about the eclipse. Maybe I'll rent my house for $1,000 a night. And
can you? Because Rocky River banned Airbnbs. We cannot do short-term rentals here.
Yeah.
Because that was like the big hubbub.
But by the time anyone finds out we did this.
No. We're not advocating breaking the law. Not on Today in Ohio. We're a law-abiding podcast. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Ohio Auditor Keith Faber found a surprisingly high number of people receiving Medicaid in Ohio who were also getting it from other states. Lisa, how many and what happens to them?
I am not sure what happens to them. I know they're going to look into it. But yeah, Keith Faber's report found that 124,448 Ohioans on Medicaid got benefits from at least one other state between 2019 and 2022. And they were paid more than $1 billion in payouts. The double dipping was the highest in 2022, and it was $321 million paid out to people who were double dipping. That's about 1.1% of the total state Medicaid spending. All he said was that the Ohio Department of Medicaid needs to do more to address the issue. Some of the Ohio recipients were enrolled in 46 other states, Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. The highest numbers of double dippers were in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, and Indiana. ODM Deputy Director Stephen Voigt, he had a 21-page response. He first questioned the report's methodology and its conclusions. He says that they were restrained by a federal law during the COVID public health emergency that banned them from kicking people off the Medicaid rolls. And he said it was harder to disenroll recipients that were potentially relocating. He said the state would have had to repay the extra Medicaid money paid out if the feds, you know, to the feds if they ignored the requirements.
Yeah, okay, I get it. This, you can say that the Medicaid office isn't to blame for this, but a whole bunch of people double-dipped, you would think there'd be some accountability. Although, let's face it, you know, we never cracked down on all those people that did the unemployment fraud during mm-hmm. the pandemic either, and there was much bigger losses to the state of Ohio from that. Maybe they're just going to let it go.
I mean, they haven't said that there's going to be any investigation. They just said, hey, you know, the Medicare office needs to do more. And that's what we've heard. And the Medicaid office is like, wait one, we don't like your report conclusions. And he said that they never provided a sample of the 125 residents that they used in the audit.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We wondered Wednesday whether the Cleveland port might pick up freight traffic while the Baltimore port remains closed by the bridge collapse. There's an estimate that that closure will only last 6 weeks now. Reporter Pete Krause brought us the answer. Layla, what is it?
Well, Pete said as shippers reroute their freight, it's unlikely that much of it, if any, will pass through Cleveland. Will Friedman, the president and CEO of the Port of Cleveland, said it's possible that the Port of Cleveland could see a little more non-container cargo like steel because there are already established routes for that commodity between the Great Lakes and Europe. But Friedman kind of doubts it. For the most part, freight will be absorbed by competing East Coast ports or sit on the dock waiting for the Port of Baltimore to reopen, because Baltimore is a major port for container ships like the one that struck the bridge Tuesday. The large container ships are too big to make their way up the St. Lawrence Seaway to Cleveland, and they will go to other East Coast ports like Norfolk, Virginia, which is on the route to Baltimore as ships make their way up the Chesapeake Bay. So the New York, New Jersey, Boston, and Philadelphia ports could all see more business, he said, and even possibly ports further south in Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. But Cleveland's a stretch. It's more likely shipments will just wait until ships can access the port in Baltimore again. So I'm wondering if this all means get ready for supply chain problems.
Yeah, that's what struck me about this. My perception had been that the ports on the East Coast were all very, very busy and that they don't have a lot of capacity for increasing. But I heard from somebody on my texting account who knows the industry, and they said, oh, no, no, they can absorb it. And Will Friedman says, yeah, they'll absorb it. So I guess they're not at capacity and that there's room to pick up some of this. Or like you said, there'll be long delays and we'll have supply chain issues. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Sean Diddy Combs has some serious storm clouds on the horizon involving a criminal investigation. And this week, an arrest in the case has a big tie to Northeast Ohio. Laura, who got arrested?
A young man from Chagrin Falls named Brendan Paul. He's 25, a former Hawken basketball star, and he is accused of being Sean Combs' drug mule. He was arrested this week on cocaine charges in Miami. Published reports say he's under federal investigation involving sex trafficking as well. And he's named in this lawsuit filed by an artist and music producer as being a close ally of Combs. I want to know how this happened. He's 25. He's from Chagrin Falls. How did he get into Diddy's entourage? I'm not sure. And the court documents don't make it clear how he became any kind of ally of Combs, who's, of course, a longtime rap icon. So in the lawsuit filed in federal court in New York, Paul is identified as works as Mr. Combs' mule, acquires and distributes Mr. Combs' drugs and guns. And he's not listed as a defendant in the case, but he's named throughout the lawsuit.
But what's odd is didn't Paul play basketball at Syracuse? I mean, he was in.
He did.
So he hasn't been out of college and in the world very long. So you're right. How did he get involved in this so quickly?
Yeah, he went from Syracuse to transfer to Fairmont State University in West Virginia. I'm not sure if he played basketball there, and I don't know for sure that he graduated. But he's 25. He's young. Yeah, that's like 3 years out of college. How do you even meet Diddy at this point?
Yeah. As soon as the arrest happened, we started hearing from lots of people in our area saying, you need to do a story about this. There are people who are aware of who he was from his high school basketball career, I guess.
Wasn't one of the emails titled Local Kid Done Good or something like that? It was just very facetious because, yeah, you would never, this is wild.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure when they make arrests like this, they're looking to get people to make deals and provide information. And a 25-year-old is probably naive and likely to talk. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That's it for Thursday. Come back Friday. We'll wrap up the week of news. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thank you for listening.